My name's Carol, and I'm an alcoholic. I am overwhelmed with gratitude today, just washed over with gratitude today. If you knew who I was and what I was, I wouldn't be up here today. It's just an honor and a privilege to be here. I was trying to get perspective on this when I found out it was the international ballroom I was speaking at least last night it wasn't the big meeting. That's the only perspective I could get out of this deal. Lower. And if someone has trouble hearing, just wave your arms in the back room. My sobriety date is January 28th, 1987. I share that sobriety date with my sister. We walked in at the same time, and we have shared this journey since then. Our mother loves Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was told what the topic would be, it has just been the coolest thing. I think I was told in April or May that I got to speak, and I realize it is a privilege and an honor. I'm not sure what I'm feeling right now, but I know later it'll be a privilege and an honor that I got to have this experience. But I love the topic, and since then I have spent a lot of time aware of the opportunities to practice these principles. So I want to know during this, or I want to tell you during this convention, I have done so well practicing the principles until the Marta. And I got to tell you, I apologize to the little old ladies I ran over to get on that bus last night. Oh, my goodness. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't practicing any principles. One of my first experiences drinking, well, I started drinking when I was about 13 or 14 years old. I ended up with an unplanned pregnancy. First, I started out like a fairly normal child. I suppose at least when we were born, we all started out fairly normal child. But I wanted to be a nurse, and I wanted to be a mother and a wife. That was just growing up. And so when I ended up drinking and pregnant in high school and terminated that pregnancy, it was one of my first consequences of my drinking. And I carried that load along with me and kept piling on one more brick and one more brick, walking over the morals that I had been taught as a child. I tell you that story because as my drinking progressed, I terminated another pregnancy. And then towards the end, ended up pregnant again. Taking a birth control pill was very difficult to remember when you're drinking on a daily basis. So towards the end of my drinking, when I got pregnant and decided to have that baby, that is the first time I realized I could not not drink. I knew it was wrong. There was no lie I could tell myself that made that okay, and I could not not drink. I remember sitting at the local bar about, I should back up, because part of our story, which is overwhelming, my sister and I should share this with another sister. We got a call when I was a couple months pregnant that her boyfriend had murdered her, and during that time, pregnant, knowing you shouldn't drink, having no tools to deal with anything as horrific as that, that's all I could do was drink, and it didn't work. It's one of those feelings of nothing took away that kind of pain. And so now I'm pregnant, alone, discouraged, and no solution. So I was sitting at the bar 6-7 months pregnant. And this is one of those bars where it's the end of the line bar. People get there at 8 a.m. and, you know, you're snorting coke in the bathroom and you're doing shots and it's where all your companions hang out. And I got up to the bar and I said, I need a shot. And the bartender said, you can't drink. You're pregnant. I don't know if you've experienced that kind of shame and guilt, but that's the best I could do at the time. That is the best I could do at the time. So I am so grateful that my story doesn't last much longer. My story of alcoholism doesn't last much longer than that. But it was probably 2 months after my son was born. I had drove drunk, I couldn't even breastfeed because I couldn't stay sober long enough to do that. And so I had used up all the possible babysitters I had had. It was Super Bowl Sunday. I used a coworker for a babysitter. Who knew the Super Bowl started at 4? I thought it started in the morning. When I sobered up, I was like, really? It doesn't start till 4:30 in the afternoon? I remember starting way earlier than that, but I know I had probably asked her to watch my son for a couple hours. When I picked him up at 2 in the morning, not having checked on him, not having called her any time during the Super Bowl, I had that moment of clarity that I hope you've all had. That moment of truth where I could no longer avoid who and what I had become. I like this part of the story because that is the last drink of alcohol or drug use I have ever had to have, and I plan on never having. So it's... So now we talk about this practicing the principles. I loved the message last night about just stay. Just stay. I still am not doing this 100% right. But when I got here, I got a sponsor because they said you had to. That had not worked the steps, but we met every week for coffee. She taught me unconditional love. She taught me how to be honest in this program. She taught me so many things. Unfortunately, we did not do the program, but I was able to stay. I want to know that we get to a place in sobriety where we need to begin the work that they talk about. I heard yesterday, most every speaker talked about getting to that place where we need to dig deeper, where we need to, and it comes as long as we stay. So I want to talk about some of the practicing the principles that have been, first of all, I left it there because that's what God thinks is funny. I have these little notes. They do these bookmarks that talks about, we hear it, how it works all the time. It's read, it talks about the principles in there 3 or 4 times. Practicing these principles in all our affairs, the 12 steps, continuing to practice these principles. But so very seldom do we talk about what those principles are, the honesty, faith, courage. So I like that bookmark because it talks about the step, the tradition, the concept, and what principle goes along with that. So honesty, when I got here, I, believe it or not, came in here with this illusion that at least I was cash register honest. I said those things. At least I was cash register honest. When I started working the steps, I stole, cheated from every employer I had. Literally took money out of a cash register and stuck it in my pocket. Not only the time and the energy that I stole from every employer, but cash from every employer. So the importance of honesty today for me is, it is like the road has narrowed and I am free. I love that I'm speaking on Independence Day because I truly am free. But just the other day at work, we mark a little mark when you take a soda out of the fridge and then you pay it back. I have clients that I grab a soda and I'm like, oh, I'm busy. And then it's like, no, I need to go back and mark that little mark that I took a soda out of the fridge. It is that important today to be honest in all of my affairs. And work is one of the biggest places where I need to be honest in all of my affairs. I have to look at my timer. He said we couldn't time ourselves, but can't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I've worked the steps several times, and each time they give me a new meaning, a new freedom, a new experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you about one of the last amends I made, and then one that happened to me. There was a fellow in the program, and I get where I want to watch out for the newcomers, and I'm fairly rigid in the meetings, and I want to keep it AA. I had got my nose into business that was not mine, and that happens quite often. But anyway, this fellow, I had called on his stuff, and so I talked to my sponsor about it, and I'm like, I don't think I owe him amends because I am right, and he is... And he was out of line. It's just his story to figure that out. It's not mine. But so she's gentle with me, and she's like, you should pray about that. And I prayed. I also, my next time around, he made it on the list, but I wasn't really willing. And so I hadn't seen him at meetings for quite a while, and I saw him at a meeting, but he was on the other side of the room. And so I'm like, well, God, if you want me to make this amends, you would have him sit by me. And so this is 24 years sober, so keep coming back. It works. But what I want to tell you is then I didn't make it that day, and now I'm starting to feel heavier and heavier and heavier. And the next time I saw him, I just said, can I talk to you for a few minutes, and shared with him how I was so out of line, and we each have our lessons to learn and our stories, and that I regretted having gotten into his stuff. I'll tell you, when I left there, this is the deal. I didn't realize how heavy I felt until I could feel the lightness that comes from doing the deal. I will rationalize my behavior. I will tell you why it was the right thing to do. The deal is, though, it makes a difference. We got to do the deal. We do. So another one that was kind of a big deal for practicing the principles. When I got into sobriety, I had three or four buddies that we just hung out with all the time, just really bosom buddies or whatever, went to all the roundups, went to things. And then one day this fellow just quit calling me, wouldn't take my calls, wouldn't do. And that was, I felt like I didn't know how to be a friend, that I had done something wrong in this situation. And so I wrote cards and I tried and then prayed about it and let it go. Just let it go. It was last summer, and I talk about the healing in the program, but it was last summer I got a call from him that he was dying. And I'll tell you, we had this brief moment where I drove 10 hours in a snowstorm to see him, and he got to share with me that it was nothing to do with me. It was nothing to do with me. He had had a little argument, and his pride was hurt, and that was the end of that. When we're in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are all wounded. We are all hurt. And so stumbling along, I have learned that it's not always about me. It is not always about me. So I appreciated that God had given me that moment of healing with that guy, and he passed away a week or two later. So I know a lot of times I get a little frustrated at work and other areas that other people don't have to do this deal, and I do. And I was so grateful that that guy was working his program, practicing the principles, and we got to have some healing in that. I want to tell you now some of the struggles I have. It's at work, but this is one, the principles, the humility. I still have trouble. I want people to know what I've done. I don't know if you guys have. I want people to know I did good deals. And so my... It's bad to say that out loud, but it's the truth. Most of us probably feel that way. But I have a difficult time doing a good deed and then not getting found out for it. And so that has been some direction for me, to just try to do nice things and get the joy of doing that instead of wanting to be recognized. I've had more, and this is bad to say, more meetings on folding towels in my job than any other thing. My topic, that's what's bothering to me today. That is pretty sad when that's the biggest problem I have, is that I'm folding too many towels. Well, here was an awakening I got. I know it, and this is on an international convention. Here's this awakening I got. Never once have I complained about getting more than my share. Never once have I complained about getting more than my share. Do I ever think about just doing more than my share? Doing more than my share. So today, in an act of service, which is one of the principles I have learned, I will try to step aside when someone wants to get on the MARTA. Open the door for someone else to walk through. Let someone in front of me in line. I will try to practice the principles that give me the freedom that this program offers. So thank you for letting me share at this beautiful meeting and the smiling, beautiful faces out there. Thank you.
Y'all were in a stadium last night and enjoyed the three speakers. Was one came a long distance, gave me a little flag from Australia. Our next speaker, who brings you spiritual gift number two, comes to us from Israel. Our messages are indeed international. He got lured here through Canada. Fortunately, he didn't get lost in the high mountains of Canada. I forgot the name of your home group again. I'm just gets nervous when you get up here. You forget things. You draw a blank. But I give you Larry from Israel, and he will tell you his home group. Larry?
Hi, I'm Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. No, that's real anonymous. We tell the newcomers, you can come, you can be anonymous. You don't even have to give your real name. I'll give you my real name. My real name is John. I'll give you my last name after the meeting if you want it. So I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. what can I say? I am just the guy that is trying to stay sober another day. You know, I really am grateful that you're here to help me stay sober today. You know, I woke up this morning and I talked to my friend Lil, who is a friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, how could I possibly speak at this meeting like I'm so cynical? And she says, you're not cynical, you're droll. Oh, okay. I'm not sure I know what droll means. She's a literature professor, so I don't know. I tell my daughter, I said, you know, I believe cynicism is a game of a young person. When I was a young man, I certainly was cynical, and booze helped fuel that attitude. I now have the attitude, I want a T-shirt made up that says, always skeptical, never cynical. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me to keep an open mind. And, of course, there was one or two old-timers that said, don't keep it so open that your brains fall out. So I'm really happy and astounded to be here. And I don't know. They say to start with what it was like. I am the son of a schizophrenic mother and a rageaholic father. And I was just, you know, did a tour in North America and talked to one of my many siblings, and she says, you know, I'm 54, she's in her late 50s, and she's saying, you know, it's very strange to be raised in a household with a psychotic mother. And I said, yeah, you might want to go talk to a mental health professional about that. It's certainly something that helped me. I talked to a mental health nurse in the mid 80s. The same friend Lil had took me there in catatonic state to the mental health clinic of McMaster University Hospitals, and there the mental health nurse told me that I had emotions and that I probably should pay attention to them. And I found out later that this mental health clinic doesn't treat alcoholics because as alcoholics, when it comes to doing the work that's needed to become mentally healthy, apparently most of us just drink instead of doing the work. So I had told her how much I drank, like I had told my gastroenterologist at about the same time in the mid-80s, which was the quantity I drank outside the home divided by two. And each of them said, wow, that's quite a bit for a young man. What this mental health nurse did for me was to open up to me the possibility of change. And it was many years before I changed enough that I could walk into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just as my parents gave me many things, it was a difficult childhood, but through the grace of this program, I've had an opportunity to have amends with them both. I'm on good terms with both of them. My father's quite healthy, he's 83. My mother is still a schizophrenic, and now she has dementia, and she's in a home, and this time she recognized me when I showed up. She didn't say, oh, yeah, he's one of ours. She has four sons. So she recognized me. And what she was saying to me was before I left, and I never know when it's the last time I'm going to see her, right? I told my father, you got to keep in mind, I don't have a normal relationship with my mother. That's such a thing. It's impossible. But she said to me, I love you, which she had said before, but it's very hard to connect to schizophrenics. And she had said this once before. She says, in my heart, I love you. And I understood. I understood that she knows, some part of her knows, schizophrenia is a disease of denial, like almost 100%, just like alcoholism. And I knew that she was in her disease reaching out and saying, saying that she was in her heart. And I understood that everything she tried to do, all the bad jobs she did raising me, the lack of connection, the lack of bonding. But in her own way, she was reaching out from within that disease to say that she loved me. And that's what that's what I'm doing with my alcoholism, is I'm reaching out to the ones I love and to you from deep inside of my disease and trying to say those words, to say that I love you. And that's extremely difficult for me to do. The weird thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that when I came to these rooms, there was that bond, that I saw a little connection when I started to hear what you had to say. But I didn't hear it from you, and I didn't hear it from the nifty speakers. My first sponsor was a schizophrenic, and he was sober about 5 years at the time, and he was this is it's a candle. Okay. Okay, the fire marshal won't like this, but could you all light a candle and let's have a gratitude meeting? Charlie J. left me back into health, and I could hear what he had to say. And it's my fervent hope that something I say today might speak to the person that can't hear anybody else, because that's what you did for me. Okay, I certainly qualify as an alcoholic. I didn't drink long. They taught me to drink in college, and I had a lot of fun for 2 years. I am a little bit of a nervous person, and with a few drinks in me, I can talk to girls and dance and stuff like that. It was really amazing, and I loved it. Raised with this type of mother, I've always had trouble, you know, being on this earth. You know, when she would have, what do you call them? Not visions. What are they called? Hallucinations. When she would have hallucinations, I kind of half believe them. You know, I live amongst the angels and fairies. Really, you want to know the truth? My profession is hard science, but really my heart is in the clouds, and I have trouble walking on this earth, and I really appreciate Alcoholics Anonymous for helping me walk on this earth, because you hold my hand and bring me down, you know, and to the earth, like not below the earth, okay, and I love it, you know, this is where I'm supposed to be. So alcohol sort of took me out of that. I always wanted to lift up in the clouds, and I like the oblivion. My father, who probably could be described at times as a heavy drinker, very occasionally, he couldn't afford much. He bought us food and clothing first for, you know, 7 children. But he told me this time, he said, yeah, he blacked out once or twice. And I said, yeah, I did. And it was great. You know, I had drink to the point of blackout. And he goes, you do that on purpose? And for me, that was the point. That was to be lifted off this planet, you know. And I think I'm convinced now that this is where I'm supposed to be. And so I'm here because I'm a drunk driver, and it was my second time being arrested. None of my siblings have been arrested, and the men of Alcoholics 12, Ancaster 12 and 12 near Hamilton, Ontario, loved me back into health. And you know, there was a guy there named Harold who would say things like, you know, if you put a shot of whiskey in front of me, and $100,000, and said, if you take that shot of whiskey, you can have the $100,000. He said, I wouldn't do it. And the miracle of AA is that at that time, I believed him. And I think the true miracle of AA is that now I can honestly say that, is that I know that if I had a shot of whiskey, is that $100,000 wouldn't nearly begin to compensate the type of damage that I would do from then on. You know, my friend Lil says, you're telling me that these 60,000 people, if they had like one drink, like, you know, it would be mayhem? and I said, we've already caused a lot of mayhem. I've had wonderful experiences in AA. You know, it's they talk about, you know, sunlight of the spirit. My friend Lil go, happy, joyous, free, happy, joyous, free. That's a great... I've never been at a convention where people are so happy and open and honest. And I said, yeah, but you know, you see us during these 2 days. You don't see us when we're at home and we're grumbling. You know, I go home and try to convince my home group that my wife is a monster. I made the mistake of introducing her. So now they know I'm lying. That I like that principle of honesty, and I'll give it a go. I think one of the principles is certainly openness. You know, like I said, openness is an open-mindedness. And so, you know, I went to these conventions. I went to San Diego in 1995 with my good friend Nancy, and we made up these buttons, AAA, and we handed them out, and other people gave us buttons, and it was really cool. And neither one of us could imagine standing behind one of these podiums. Or, for example, in San Antonio, I got to carry the Israeli flag, and it's amazing. The amazing thing is not so much that I got to carry the flag. It's to, you know, who am I carrying it for? And I was carrying it for my daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, that was sitting in the audience with my wife up at front in the nice seats, the family. And I got to wave around. I got to know the guy from Iran really well. That was pretty cool. And you walk up front, you wave the flag, and you move to the side, and then it's the next guy's turn. It's like the principle of rotation, only really quick. And you put your flag in the whole thing, and eventually you get to sit down. And my daughter leaned over and stretched out and grabbed my hand and said, "Papa, you did really well." Yeah, I can now wave a flag without tripping and falling over. But when you have 50,000 people cheering, you go, can I get my own TV show or something? Only in Alcoholics Anonymous can you be famous for 15 seconds and the people don't even know your name. But my name is absolutely not important. I recommend you take everything I say with a grain of salt. I really do. You know, like again, I'm just trying to stay sober for another day. And what's amazing about that is that in 1995, I was trying to get this girl to marry me, and I went to San Diego with two beautiful women, my friend Nancy and my girlfriend Miriam. We had been together just for, I don't know, I think we were together about 8 years at that time. And Miriam had gone from, oh yeah, maybe we'll get married one day, to, you know, by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, she didn't want any talk of marriage. You know, in 95, February 95, I said I went to talk to the rabbi, and she says, "I'm not marrying you." She knew that I was thinking about converting, and I said, "Oh, this isn't about marriage." She knew I was lying, but it didn't. Nancy knew that during this trip that I had went out and bought a ring, and it was in my pocket the whole time. After the conference, Miriam and I went to tour California. It was neat at the conference being with these two beautiful women, and the guys would come up, and sometimes they get so confused they would ask me, "Who are you with?" Because they wanted to know who to hit on, right? So we tour California, and we come up to San Francisco, went to meetings there. I used to not leave the little cafe where I was drinking a beer, go a couple blocks down to see a musical festival. And now, I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in over 42 cities and towns throughout the world, you know, throughout Europe and North America. And one of these places was San Francisco, and we came on down. At Joshua Tree National Monument, you know, the moon was rising and the sun was setting, and I took her out into the desert, and I asked her to, you know, there was actually a baby left in a van, and it was crying, and I said, "If I ever had a kid, I wouldn't do that," you know. Subtly. We're alcoholics, they're so subtle. And so in this, we got her alone, and I asked her to marry me. And she got really angry because, a proposal is kind of an ultimatum, right? So she said maybe. And I learned much, much later from the woman in Alcoholics Anonymous that maybe means yes. But I could only get to that point because some women in AA had, one of the women took me aside and told me, you know, "You want to get married, you know, women like to raise kids in the backyard. Do you have a backyard?" I say, "Yeah." "And is it nice?" "Well, there's a Doberman Pinscher in there, but other than that, it's nice." And she said, "Maybe you want to change your attitude." So I did things like I started doing the dishes, you know, leaving the parking spot for her and stuff like that. So Miriam said, "Maybe." I was only 3.5 years sober, so I think that's a really good thing to say to someone who's 3.5 years sober. I say, how long do I have to wait? Oh, well, a year. You know, the truth is that if a guy wants to marry you, he'll still want to marry you a year from now. You know, that's a, I think that's pretty much a fact. So so a year later, we got married, and I had the AA friends there, and, you know, not this many people at our wedding. We couldn't afford that. And a group. And the next conference, my friend Nancy was with her husband and child at Minneapolis, and I was there with my daughter Seema in Minneapolis. And then Toronto, I thought, was a no-brainer that I could just take the bus there. But by that time, I was in Israel. My wife had gotten a job in Israel and said, you know, let's go out there, try that for a couple years. And so we did. And it was 14 years ago, you know. She got me enrolled in a graduate program there, and she knew that was going to take more than 2 years, so I was kind of tricked into there. Israel is different from here. We are at our meetings, you know, for quite a while I was sat at a meeting alone, and that was for about a year I sat at a meeting alone. There were guys there when I got there, and they left, and it's okay. I wouldn't let the fact that I was the only person at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting keep me from being at that meeting. And eventually someone else showed up. So it was me and Lalief were sitting there. And then other people showed up. A real annoying American came by not long ago. And he had like this chip system. And, you know, he wanted to do this chip system. I rolled my eyes and kept my mouth shut. But the newcomers, they really, really, really liked this chip system. And then we, you know, this other guy from North America showed up. And then some more newcomers. So, and then this loudmouth American, he said, oh, let's go out for coffee afterwards and dinner afterwards, maybe. So we started doing that. So now we have a little fellowship going. And, you know, it goes on from there. Now we have some newcomers. I've been talking to a newcomer for about a year now, this religious guy. And there's a big problem amongst the religious community. And I'm really hoping that it sticks for him. And so so I've been working on it every week. I go see him, that stuff like that. And so how it works in Israel, we not many meetings, so we text and stuff like that. I got a text last week, this loudmouth American. He says, so-and-so has just done his fifth step with me. He still wants you as a sponsor, but he doesn't want to do his fifth step with you. I say we kind of do tag team on this. And so there's a principle. Is jealousy a principle? No. I think humility is a principle. And so I wrote him back, okay, we'll give this guy whatever he can take. And then I also tagged onto that, but please stay away from my wife. I don't want any more surprises while I'm out here. Look, you've all been very amusing, and I would like to stay up here for another 6 months so I could get 24 years of sobriety. I sobered up January 4th, 1993, and. Haven't done it by myself. That religious guy who, you know, is also, let's call him very droll, okay? I say, you know, I was reading the Psalms this morning. He goes, the Psalms? You know, like I'm pretty secular. I'm not that religious. The Psalms. Yeah, we're allowed to read that stuff even if we're not that religious. And he wrote out in Hebrew for me, so I apologize to Rivka, who introduced herself. This isn't my bad Hebrew. I'm in Israel 14 years, and I don't know the language very much. But the meetings there are in bomb shelters, which are really appropriate because occasionally there is a missile. Missiles landed when we were in a meeting in Haifa in 2006. Two missiles hit Haifa, and we were in a meeting in a bomb shelter. We finished up the meeting and start walking up the stairs, and the neighborhood's walking into the bomb shelter. And I think the principle there is an AA meeting is always a good place to be. My friend wrote this out in Hebrew for me. Korov Adonai le nishabare alav ve'et teke ruach Yeshua. And it means, sorry about that, Rivka. It means something like God is close to the brokenhearted, and the crushed spirit God saves. I've had the good fortune to know enough newcomers that I can say, my heart is broken. And I have had the privilege to be in these AA meetings to say that God has saved my crushed spirit. My friend Lil says this, in the end, it's going to be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not the end. Thank you.
And again, thank Larry and John. From way out west, we have Lori from, is it Massachusetts? On the east side.
Good God. Put this down. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Lori. That's God telling me to shut up. My home group is the West Bridgewater Now Group in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts. My sobriety date is February 1st, 2005. And I will say I'm nervous. I was going to ask where the barf bags were, but there aren't any up here. Sorry. We'll start from the beginning. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a raging alcoholic. I grew up in a home where you never knew if he was going to be passed out or asleep, brought home by the cops, in a fist fight with his brother in the front yard from, during a family gathering. And I always said I saw what he put my mom through, and I saw what he put us kids through, and I said, I'm not going to be like that. So I wasn't an alcoholic like him. I was an alcoholic like me, because everybody's experience is just a little bit different. Grew up, my parents split up when I was about 12, and it was shortly thereafter that I did pick up my first drink. And I had always said, after my parents split, my mom was working two jobs, and I said, I'm going to have to get a scholarship to go to college, because she won't be able to afford it, and he's not going to pay for it. And I wasn't going to drink, and I wasn't going to do drugs. And within a year, I started settling for less. I gave into that peer pressure, and I picked up a drink. And all my life, I had grown up, and I knew I was loved. I knew in my head that I was loved. I come from a huge family, and I know that every single one of them loved me in their own way, but I never felt it. I knew it up here, but I didn't feel it here. There was always something missing. And for me, when I picked up that first drink, that hole was filled. And I know now that that was just the alcohol trying to rein me in. And when you're running over signposts when you're in high school, you might have a problem. But as soon as I picked up that drink, I started settling for less. My grades dropped. Sorry. Usually people are telling me to tone it down. I work with the elderly, so I scream a lot. So I started settling for less. The grades dropped. I wasn't honest at all with my mother. you know, she didn't know what to do with me. I spent more time grounded and then bugging the crap out of her until she let me out of the house. So, you know, and that's just the way it went. I barely graduated from high school, and I always made sure when I got out of high school, you know, drinking age had just gone back up to 21, which I was really aggravated at. But there was always somebody in my crowd that could buy. Either they looked old enough or they were old enough, and I always made sure that those people were in my group. And then I remember there was a guy that we used to party with, and we ended up getting married at the age of 19, which really wasn't a smart idea. I was married at 19, separated at 20, and divorced at 21. My 21st birthday, I sat there. It was a Saturday night, the 17th of March, and as soon as it hit midnight, I hit the bar because, yay, I'm now 21. Lady at the bar argued with me, and then when we finally told her, you know, no, it's midnight now. It is the 18th. I can then, you know, for the next 2 hours, last call was at like 1:30. I drank for free. It was great. And after that marriage ended, I started dating a guy, and I thought, you know, he drank like I did. But at some point in that relationship, my drinking surpassed his. And he decided he was going to break up with me, and I was like, how dare you? Do you know who I am? And came out of a blackout screaming. I was turfing the field across the street from his house and screaming obscenities at 1 in the morning. I'm not sure how I got home that night, but I remember the four-day hangover. I was on the verge of losing my job. I hadn't been arrested for a DUI yet, so I kept that bottle that I had drank, and I put it on my bureau, and I said, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink anymore. I have a problem. I wouldn't say I was an alcoholic. I decided I was a binge drinker. And my dad at this point was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. He had gone for 2 years and graduated. So I knew that AA was out there, but I said, I don't need it. I'm not an alcoholic. And then my sister-in-law, in all her wisdom, decided that she had a guy for me who didn't drink, and she thought it would be a good idea if the two of us got together. And he and I dated, and then 3 months into that relationship, I hadn't picked up a drink. I had no desire to pick up a drink. 3 months into that, I got word that my grandmother had passed away. And she was the first person I had ever lost that was that close. My mom would say, oh, my Uncle Frank died, and I had no idea who any of these people were, but my gram was my gram. And she was the heart and soul of our family. And when she passed, I went down and I was staying with my cousin. And still, I had no desire to drink. And we went to the wake and I stayed with my cousin overnight so I could go to the funeral the next day. And neither one of us could sleep. And we were, you know, swapping stories of growing up with Graham. And she went out and made herself a drink, and she came back with one for me, and she handed it to me. And because I hadn't come into the halls and I had no tools, I had no defense against that first drink, I took it. And I had no intentions of drinking when I went down there. And then I started back drinking, and I hid it from my then boyfriend. And then he found out, and that was my start of controlled drinking. We got married, two kids. I go through nursing school, and again, I'm doing this controlled drinking thing, and it's working out pretty well for me. So fast forward to when I get out of nursing school. Now, mind you, my drinking is progressing. I may still only be drinking on the weekends, but it's the amount that I'm drinking, and it's why I'm drinking. I'm not drinking because I want to anymore. I'm drinking because I have to. I'm planning out that Friday night, and the weekends went from starting on Friday to Thursday, from Thursday to Wednesday, and then they continued till it was just one long weekend, and I was hiding booze in the house. And, you know, it just got to a point where I had to drink before I went anywhere. If there was a party, I had to drink before I got there because I knew I wouldn't be able to drink like I wanted to once I got there. My ex-husband to this day will tell you I'm not an alcoholic because he had no idea how much I was drinking. Whether he was in denial or not, I'm not sure. The thing that I always looked at was I wasn't an alcoholic because I didn't do the things my dad did. I never drank at work, never drank in the morning. 4 a.m. is the morning, but I hadn't gone to bed yet, so that didn't count. And then at noontime, that drink would be sitting on the counter waiting for it to hit noontime. you know, I hadn't gotten a DUI. I hadn't lost a job because of my drinking. All of these things that my dad had done that I didn't. So the denial was there. My ex-husband and I separated in 2004. I had had it with him because he was getting aggravated with my drinking. And finally, I said, you know what, then go live with your mother because I'm done. I'm done. And my son went to live with him. We had two children, and my daughter stayed with me. And through that summer, I continued to drink like I wanted to because he was no longer there to restrict me. All right, this is getting weird. You know, I would go to work, and I had my different liquor stores that I would go to, you know, throughout the week because, you know, that guy behind the counter is always monitoring how much you drink. I'm waiting for Ghostbusters to come flying through the door. And I would go home, and I would pick up my daughter from daycare, and I would bring her home, and I was too worried about getting my drink to make sure that she had something to eat. I was too worried about getting my drink. Holy cow. Oh, blinded. There we go. I was too worried about getting that drink to make sure that she was in bed on time. And throughout that summer, when she wasn't with me, she'd go with her dad every other weekend, and I made sure, even though she's screaming, I don't want to go, I'm like, no, you're going, because then I knew I could really drink and do what I wanted. And throughout that summer, my son didn't come over as much. He had really started pulling away from me. And during that summer, I watched that little girl who was the light of my life, this bright ray of sunshine, withdraw into herself and lose weight, because I was too busy trying to drink. At the end of that summer, my soon-to-be ex convinced me to let her move in with him so that he was hoping I would get help, and I'm going, oh, yeah, now I don't have to worry about making supper because now I can drink like I want to. And I willingly gave her up and gave her to her father so that I could drink like I wanted to, and I continued to do so for the next 3 months. On January 31st, 2005, I took what I hope would be my last drink. And like a true alcoholic, I had gone to the bookstore because I thought maybe I would have I had a problem with alcohol. So I went to Borders and I bought the big book and the 12 and 12. And then I went home and drank and read them both. I got enough out of it to know that I had a problem. I identified with Bill's story. I identified with the feelings and the emotions and everything else. So 2 weeks later, I was at home alone, shades drawn because everybody's going to look in the windows at me. Had my smoke, my cigarettes, my remote, and my bottle, and I thought I was happy. I thought, yay, I've arrived. And it finally hit me that that's not what I wanted. And I couldn't go anywhere because I was too drunk, so I went online because I'm, you know, I can still function with the keyboard. And I found a room online, a Friends of Bill room. And I went into that room and proceeded to whine and cry. And they're going, you know, you don't have to drink again. They were 12-stepping me through the internet. And I still talk to some of these people today, and I am forever grateful that they talked me through it. And I remember looking at the bottle, and I forget how much it had in it. And I remember thinking, you need to finish that, because if not, you will have to drink tomorrow. Because the thought of dumping it down the sink just never entered my mind. I don't know what I did, but I didn't drink the next day. And I started going to meetings, and when I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was in the basement of a church in the town that I grew up in, and it was a step meeting, and I had no idea what you people were doing. And they were all old people because it was a noontime meeting, so it was all the retired people in the area. And, you know, we went around the room, and the first time I said, my name is Lori, and I am an alcoholic, and this is my first meeting, I had come home. I'm in a room full of people that you're from all over the world, and I don't know 99.9% of you, but I feel like I am home because you understand what goes on in my head and what goes on in my heart. So I jumped in. I got my home group. I started living these principles because I didn't have any principles when I was drinking. I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And I started I did the steps from the wall. I read them off. I'm like, yep, okay, I got that one. Four, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. You know, and I went through and I did them, and then you know what? But I did it step by step, and I did it as I could do it. I did it to the best of my ability. And I was enveloped in my first home group. There were these big, scary biker guys, kind of looked like Bill, the long hair, and they petrified me. But you know what? They swallowed me up, and they took me along, and they taught me how to have fun and sobriety, and they taught me, they brought me to meetings. I started going on meetings before I could speak. I had a job in my home group, and I got my year medallion, and my kids were excited, and I was excited. And I remember I became secretary of that group. It was shortly after my 1 year. And a month later, I went to the doctor for a physical, and within 3 weeks, I had been diagnosed with cancer. And that group, again, surrounded me with love, and I had what I needed. I was still honest, open-minded, and willing. Somewhere along the way, as I went through treatment and I was getting rides to meetings, I was going to meetings, I was still had a job in my group, but that I did to the best of my ability, I stopped being honest. Because I thought, and this was the disease in my head, when you asked me how I was doing, I would say, fine. We all know what that means. I would say, okay. But I wasn't honest, because you know what, when you're going through cancer treatment, no matter how good of a day you've had, you're not fine and you're not okay. And those walls that I had before I got sober started going back up. I was still going to meetings on the outside. I was doing everything I was supposed to, but I wasn't honest. I wasn't open-minded, and I wasn't willing. I wasn't willing to ask for help when I needed it. 3 months into that, I mean, I made it through the cancer treatment. I did very well, but again, the hole inside of me started opening up again, and by the end of 3 months of just going through the motions and not asking for help and not praying to my higher power and not doing what I needed to do on the inside, I was suicidal and wanted to pick up a drink. And I ended up in an IOP program at 2 years sober. From that day to this, I pray every day. I ask for help every day. And if you ask me how I'm doing and I'm having a really crappy day, you're going to hear about it. Shortly after that, I joined a new home group, and I have been absolutely blessed with the people that God has put in my life. That taught me a new way to practice these principles in all my affairs. I had done the steps. I was kind of familiar with traditions, and I had complained that I was bored. And you don't do that when your sponsor is a past delegate, for those of you who know. Within a month, I was a GSR for my home group. And I started learning more about these traditions. And every day as I get to know the traditions and I practice the steps and I practice the traditions in my daily life, not only do I practice them in my home group and at the district and at the area level, I practice them in my daily life. And it's just, today I'm not a liar, a cheat, and a thief. AA has taught me so much, and in this program, I've been able to get married again. I have been able to be accountable. My employer knows that when I'm scheduled at 7, I show up at 7, and I'm actually going to do my job. The person I am on the inside, they always say, why are you so happy? I'm like, I spent too long being miserable. It's not worth it. It takes way more energy to be miserable. I'd rather be happy. And that bright, shining light, my daughter, I was texting with her, and she said, are you nervous? And I said, well, yeah. And I'm going to read to you what she said, because she is one of the reasons I continue to practice these principles. Where'd it go? I'm going to take the glasses off. She said, you'll do great, Mama. Are you sharing your story? Well, don't be nervous. How many times have you done that before? You'll do great. There's just more people this time. It'll be okay. Just remember, these people have all been through the same stuff you did, and they're there to hear your recovery. I love you. I'm proud of you. And be sure to mention me. Between my husband and I, we have three kids. We have two boys, and then there's the princess. And she's still, to this day, I've been able to make living amends to both my children. You know, and my daughter will get upset, or, you know, I'll say I'm at an all-day meeting, or if I'm at an assembly, or wherever I am. And she'll get upset, but then she'll remember that this is what I need. In order to keep it, I have to give it away. So in order to keep what I have, in order to keep my happy home, in order to keep my friends, in order to keep my kids, I need to come up here and speak, whether it's a room of however many, I don't even want to estimate how many of you there are in this room, or if it's me talking with a sponsee or with my sponsor, this is what I need to do to stay sober, and this is why I continue to practice these principles in all my affairs. Thank you.
One more time, please. Thank Carol, John, and Lori. Give it up. Outstanding.